Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Press One for Democracy. Oh, sure, I know it's supposed to be all about politics and getting money out of politics and all the good things that we do here at the Coffee Party, but you know what? It's only been a week, and I can't help but still be celebrating a little bit over my Blackhawks' second cup in 4 years, third in my lifetime. So it doesn't happen very often for us, so please forgive me, and a little celebration. But no, welcome into Press One for Democracy. You've got Dan Aronson here, your host. Today we have a somewhat interesting topic. It's been a very busy, busy time for our Supreme Court of the United States, or SCOTUS as it's known. They're turning out some decisions, which some seem okay, others not so much. So what do we feel about the Roberts Court? And why are, in poll after poll after poll, why have Americans or are Americans losing faith and losing confidence in the ability to get a fair shake out of the Supreme Court? You know, where are the court's allegiances? And let's maybe even back up and start with why should the court have allegiances to anything other than the Constitution of the United States, which they are there to interpret all laws thereby, and use the Constitution as a filter to decide which laws should stand, which laws should be stricken, or which laws should be changed. And so all of that has been going on in spades over the last couple of years. And, of course, you know, we here at the Coffee Party tend to go back to 2010 and the Citizens United decision as the place where things went wrong. But if you ask a lot of people, they'll go back to the 2001 or the 2000 election. You know, a lot of people think that they decided who the President of the United States should be, and that was the wrong thing to do. They did it by sidestepping the decision, of course, and saying, hey, it's not really our decision. Sometimes you get those non-denial denials, right? A little bit of passive aggressiveness there from our friends at SCOTUS. So, as always, this is a call-in show, so we need your input. Nobody wants to sit here and listen to me talk for an hour or so, so please call in at 646-929-2495, and when you get into the queue, you hit 1, it raises your little electronic hand on my board, and it lets me know that you want to get involved in the conversation, and again, conversation, more fun than monologue, so... See a couple of regulars have signed on, and Greg and Joe in the chat rooms. Sometimes we can get one of those guys going enough to call in. So you know, we can start by talking about a couple of different things, right? You know, lately we've seen votes in the Senate that have done what a lot of people believe is to send the civil rights era back, set us back to pre-1968 in the civil rights, especially when it comes to voting. They refused to hear the California Prop 8 case on against gay marriage, and they ruled in the Defense of Marriage Act. So seems like a lot of different things going on. But then they upheld affirmative action for college. For college admission, sorry. You know, what do you think of SCOTUS? Where is it going? And when it comes to more economic-based issues or issues surrounding Wall Street or the big business, the question is, have they really broken that veil? Have they pierced the veil? So everybody talks about, like, in civil cases, when you're suing a corporation, you've got to pierce the corporate veil if you want to get to the people behind it. And the question is, has the SCOTUS veil, so to speak, been pierced? Has somehow big money broken through, and are they influencing the court? Right. So that is obviously a big trouble, right? Because we know, and it's very clear where the legal lines are drawn that allow big money to go in and affect elections. Again, thanks to Citizens United decision. But the court, the high court, was supposed to have this kind of impenetrable, uncorruptible mechanism to it, right? They're life appointees. They're therefore not beholden to politicians, or shouldn't be. And they're certainly not held to account by the people in as much. So, that, you know, we're supposed to bring these greatest of minds on the law into this lifelong position, and therefore, well, they can't be corrupted, right? Well, there's a lot of people who think these days that they are. So, again, we want to hear from you, the callers, the listeners, and we do have a hand up. So, great. I'm going to go to 724. Area code 724, who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi, Dan. It's Greg in Pittsburgh. How are you?
Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm doing well, doing well. So I'll offer a couple of thoughts and observations and, kind of see where the conversation goes. Your question about the influence of money on the Supreme Court, I think it would be impossible for it not to have influence, and I don't think it's anything actually all that new. It's easy to be nostalgic, I think, about the past. Especially when if people are like me, where I'm the first one to admit I wasn't all that politically active until probably 10 or 15 years ago, and didn't pay that much attention, frankly, as a young guy raising kids as to, you know, what was going on the Supreme Court. But, you know, when you look at what's happened, at least as far as I can tell, over the last 10 or 12 years, I don't think there's too much lack of evidence that every Supreme Court justice, and I will admit that I think it's more on the conservative side of the court than on the liberal side of the court, is thinking about what's best for big money as opposed to what's best for just ordinary citizens.
Let's chase that assumption, if we will, for a second.
Sure.
My question is, well, I have two questions. To what end and why?
To what end is an interesting question, because if the Supreme Court justices, in fact, serve out a near lifelong term, it's not as if they're playing in the minor leagues like the congressmen and women are in order to get jobs as lobbyists. So personally, I don't know if they have maybe that golden parachute sort of mentality that elected officials seem to demonstrate a lot of interest in these days. But I don't think there's also any denying that a Supreme Court justice is, without question, one of the most elite individuals in the United States. And I'm sure they have a desire on some level to think about and make decisions about, and I hope on some level it's not just cold, calloused, you know, financial calculus that they go through. They actually do try to think about what might be best for ordinary Americans. But I think they take that I'll call it capitalist elitist attitude, that if the decisions that are made are good for the rich, it'll somehow be good for the rest of us. And again, I think I see more of that sort of thinking perhaps from the right than I do the left on the court.
Okay, so they're it's Big Brother. It's or not Big Brother. It's more like a parent. Like, oh, these people know what's best for the country, and therefore we're going to do what's best for them so that they can stay in power. Because that's
it feels more like it. Actually, I wish it actually was a little bit more like, not maybe not so much Big Brother, but, you know, a little bit more like benevolent parent or something. But I don't really see it that way. I tend to think of some of these decisions especially a decision like Citizens United, is a terrible interpretation of what's meant by, you know, the First Amendment. And I don't think they're stupid, so I have to assume that the justices that voted for that did it out of this idea that it was going to be somehow more equitable for big money interests to have more influence over what happens in elections, and that somehow that would translate into benefit to the rest of us out of this twisted notion of, you know, a trickle-down effect that happens when things go well for the wealthy, and somehow it manifests itself as benefit to the rest of us. I don't see that. I don't see a lot of evidence for that over the last, you know, 35 or 40 years of my life. And, you know, I don't know why the court would think that it's a good idea for the rest of us to not have a complete appreciation for where the money is coming from for elections. It just lends itself to so much potential for corruption. I don't understand the logic there. I just don't understand that thinking. I'm glad that they made the rulings that they did when it came to DOMA and Proposition 8. I'm not sure I'm too comfortable about the rationale, but they made the decision that seems like it's the right one. If you can't bring a case in front of the court because you don't have standing, well, then, you know, that's a technicality, basically, but I'm okay with the outcome. You know, that part of it's perfectly fine with me, because I'm a big fan of equal rights for gay and lesbian and transgender individuals. I don't know if that's really answers your question or not.
Well, I guess it's a little more cut and dry when you talk about an elected official, right? Like, here's money, do what I want you to do, right? Yeah, it's pretty simple.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
But where's the payoff? Is it a legacy thing?
You got to believe that on some level that, nine Supreme Court justices not understand the long before they even get there, that this, they will be forever immortalized as figures in history. And so, unlike the rest of us, one would think that they spend a lot of time thinking about the implications of the decisions they make for not just years, but generations to come, decades into the future, which is why I'm so mystified about why they made the decision they did about the Voting Rights Act. At a time when even people like me can look at what's happening in places like North Carolina and know that there's a huge need for voters' rights to be protected nationwide. Again, on a technicality is what it seems like. They're now sending this back to the Congress to figure out, and that to me seems like that's an activist kind of approach to say that it's no longer necessary for these states who've had to justify their decisions to force them to continue to do it. However, you know, if you guys in Congress want to figure out something different, well, then go ahead and do that. But let's stop worrying about what, you know, the southern states are thinking about when it comes to voters' rights, because that requirement was only about race. And unless you can, you know, provide evidence that there's an actual racial discrimination that's happening, then states and local officials ought to be allowed to do whatever they want. And I think that's wrong.
Right, and here's the weird juxtaposition with the two rulings, right? So they have the right to do what they want about voting, but not about college admission.
It's okay, because
they uphold affirmative action, saying it's okay, that meaning,
yes.
Look, the only reason why you uphold all affirmative action is because there's still prejudice going on within the college admissions process. obviously. Right. Otherwise, they'd say, well, it's no longer necessary, so no, forget it. But so on one hand, there's prejudice going on at the most liberal institutions in the world, right, as colleges tend to be. But when it comes to voting, yeah, everything's fine.
I just
nobody's getting discriminated against. It's ridiculous.
It's hard to put all of your faith in any one level or branch of government, and I'm not naive enough to do that. But I am a fan of a certain degree of checks and balances. And frankly, I think and I'm not the first one to come up with this. This actually, I learned this by watching the films that Eric and Annabelle are making. There was a I can't remember who he was. If he was a, I think he was a judge and a lawyer. He was part of the movement in North Carolina, and he basically made the point that the Voting Rights Act actually ought to apply to the whole country. It shouldn't be just the southern states. It ought to apply to all 50 states. And the rationale there was, to me, fairly straightforward, and that was that if we're going to protect one of the most valuable rights that we have from any kind of localized discrimination or unfair practices, then there's plenty of evidence, and I live in a state now where there's more than just a little bit. I'm in Pennsylvania. They want to pass a voter ID law here, and there's no evidence that there's a need for that because there's almost no in-person voter fraud that ever has happened, ever. Documented cases are in the teens. The problem is not with somebody showing up and pretending to be somebody they're not. So if you're going to force Pennsylvanians, and it's going to affect mostly a certain kind of voter, everybody knows that. There's no denying that. If you're poor, you don't have transportation, you got to count on somebody else to give you a ride, you got to take a bus, you got to take time off work, you don't get unpaid time off, all those things. That's a discriminatory action being taken to suppress the minority vote and the poor vote. And it's funny that poor whites don't seem to get it, but it affects them too. The Supreme Court decision on that side of it was, it unfortunately wasn't a big surprise. The surprise is that Roberts he doesn't seem to be on one side or the other on some of these issues. Who would have thought he would have said that the Affordable Care Act was constitutional? I never saw that coming.
Yep, that's pretty wild. We have a couple more callers on hold, so let me put you into on hold yourself. Appreciate the call as always. If you hit one, you'll put the little electronic hand will go down on my board, and then if you want to jump back in, or if you hang out, we may just end up having the old open mic night. So, great comments, great way to kick off the show, and we're going to go to 518, and I believe this would be Mr. Joe. How are you tonight, sir?
Dan, great. Your ad said tomorrow night at 9, just for what it's worth, so we may not have as many people participating as we'd like.
It said tomorrow?
Yeah, July 2nd. So... At least that's how it came up on Coffee Party News. I keep my eyes open. So to get to Greg, he, whether he knows it or not, requested something for Coffee Party News regarding Chief Justice Roberts and the Supreme Court. I gave a brief comment on it. The article he refers to regards to the insight of the decisions made, in particular by Chief Justice Roberts. I'd like to broaden it a little. When we're dealing with Supreme Court justices, what I've been seeing in my lifetime is they do go by basic ideologies. I don't want to try to pass judgment on that. But when you're coming down to decisions, okay, I have to go, okay, basically, what did this guy tell me when he was appointed? Did he tell me he was going to be fair? Did he tell me he had leanings one way or the other? I mean, we all do. It's just the nature of human beings. when someone crosses that line, I do have to raise questions. I would briefly point out Justice Thomas, whose wife, exempt from the office of the Supreme Court, is a Tea Party member, sponsors Tea Party events. Now, not to degrade anything for the Tea Party, but you're showing a bias. Now, dealing with some of the rulings, the Voting Rights Act probably was the most confusing to me. What they're saying, in essence, to me is, well, nobody's violating the law anymore, so we're going to let it all go. They don't need any type of monitoring or restraint. Now, let's look at it simply. If you have speeding laws in a state and the speed limit is enforced by the police, do you turn around and go, well, look, we don't need speeding laws anymore. They don't need to be enforced because nobody's speeding? You know,
I don't get the analogy because everybody speeds.
Well, but the point is there's a law against it and you can be punished for it. Okay? If there's no law against it, the odds are more and more people will speed. If you take the signs down and go, hey, drive that, you know, we're not going to monitor anything regarding how you handle your vehicle. You can do whatever you want until you get in an accident or someone reports it. Do you see where I'm coming from on that?
No, absolutely. You're right. You're saying that the law, you're saying that the fact that there is no more discrimination in voting is because there's a law that says you can't do it, and if you do it, here's your punishment. So why would you take the law away?
Now, I get into trouble with a lot of this, and I owe it to a good number of African Americans I spoke to before I retired. And I'm going to have to agree with them, I don't have a problem with voter ID. What I have a problem with is who sets the rules for who gets the ID. Okay? If you want to tell me that, okay, everybody has to have this, and what we'll do is monitor the abuses of it on a federal level through the Justice Department, I could agree with it. If you're going to say, well, each municipality, state or otherwise, can set its own rules, then I have some problems, because that can be used to discriminate against people you might, and this has nothing to do with color, people you might not want to vote in certain elections.
Well, I totally get that. Yeah, that makes no sense to me. As long as we have ballots with federally elected people, then we need a single federal standard for that, don't we? I mean,
it's
certainly in any presidential year, you've got to have same set of rules because every single person is voting in that same election. So how is it even okay? That makes no sense to me. But I have a problem with the whole. I worry about voter suppression only from the fact that is it really relevant statistically. To be honest with you, I mean, it shouldn't happen. I'm certainly not for it, but I just don't know that it's statistically.
I wouldn't argue with you on that point, but I hope what we're trying to do is facilitate some answers that will at least satisfy those that think there's a problem. And if we're going to do that, yes, it is a minority thing. Now, to lend to your thought, I wish I'd written it down. There was a commentator on a program I was watching. And if you want a very simple way of solving this, we have cell phones. They have cameras. They're digital. okay? Somebody comes to vote, you get his picture. He signs, he goes and votes. If there's a problem later on, have a photo of the person impersonating, if that's the case, of an illegitimate voter. Okay, it's very cost effective. It's very easy to do. He actually surprised me with it because I'm like, and you know, theoretically that could solve 99.9% of the problem. But you know, we have to understand there's parts of our society, okay, that seem to feel that you know they want this. I feel like they want the Berlin Wall built along the Mexican border, with snakes, alligators, and missiles and stealth bombers. Really, they're not our enemy. But, you know, we have to placate them. This wouldn't cost $20 to $40 billion. You know, and if you incorporate it in the right way with fairness, you know, it gives them no argument.
No, I hear you. I hear you. I just, I worry about priorities. I honestly worry about priorities and where we're going and politically. But I obviously voter suppression is a bad thing. It is for 99.9% of the people. It is their only way to change their government and their country. So it shouldn't be done. There's no doubt. I mean, and again, I have it easy. We vote by mail in Oregon, and yeah, you don't hear about challenges. I'll have to go research that. How many votes that have been cast by mail? All I do is sign it, and then that's it. And I send it in, and they match it up against my name on the registry, and that's it. It's done. So I don't know. I don't know enough? I think I said I don't know enough times that I'm going to open up Mr. Rodrigo's mic and let him say something more intelligent than I don't know.
Bobby's a good man to go to on this.
Hello, everybody. Gosh, I think I've been on the phone all day. A couple of things you guys have been talking about. First of all, the subject matter of the show, I don't know if there's an answer, an intelligent answer, actually, other than pure speculation, because of all the dynamics, including the fact that they're lifetime appointees, and Dan, to your point, is, you know, what is the benefit, or what is the goal, or what is the reward, or whatever it is, why would they do such a thing? There has to be a reason. I think the closest we can get to an intelligible reason is that it is based on pure ideology or nothing more. If you look at the fact that they more than likely wouldn't have time in their life to reap the benefits of any kind of reward, I suppose. But they are, in fact, siding with business regardless of the reason that they're doing it, and that is, you know, that is a tremendous aspect of what's going on in our society. I'll give you a couple of examples. Just recently, Emily Martin, who's the vice president and general counsel at the National Women's Law Center, wrote the following. She may have missed it in the flurry of newsmaking by the Supreme Court this week. This was written just last week. But on Monday, five of the justices gave early Christmas presents to defendants accused of employment discrimination when the court handed down important decisions in two Title VII cases. The cases of Vance v. Ball State University and University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center v. Nassar. In both Vance and Nassar, the 5-4 decisions ignored the realities of the workplace and the ways in which employment discrimination and harassment play out every day, placing new obstacles in the path of workers seeking to vindicate their rights. The court set aside the longstanding interpretations of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Now, I want to pause there for a minute because we've heard all these instances recently by our 1% media and discussed even on our coffee party shows on these court decisions that are significant. We're just talking about the Voters' Rights Act. Obviously, NOMA happened. Well, in the meantime, the things that are not being reported are other significant legal rulings like the one I'm reading here. The agency charged with enforcing Title VII and closed out the term which the court repeatedly limited the ability of individuals to challenge the actions of powerful corporations. Samuel Alito wrote the Vance decision. Prior cases have held that when a plaintiff shows she was sexually harassed or racially harassed or harassed on some other unlawful basis by his supervisor, her employer is liable, unless the employer can prove that the plaintiff unreasonably failed to take advantage of a process that the employer provided for addressing harassment. So that's a typical rule of law, even in our government. You first must basically exhaust your remedies that are provided to you to do things in-house without going to court, arbitration being one of them in our government legislation. And this is me talking, not Emily. Administrative Procedure Act, for example, the government is charged with following its own regulations, things like that. So they go on. So Alito goes on here and says, an employer is only liable for harassment by a coworker, however, when a plaintiff can show that the employer was negligent in controlling working conditions, a far tougher standard. Vance posed the question of who is supervisor. So this is what the issue was. A person who is a supervisor over an employee is causing this illegal action. So what the court decided to do was to come up with a new definition of what a supervisor is, and this is what happened. Is it only someone who has the authority to hire, fire, or take other tangible employment actions, or is it anyone who oversees and directs the plaintiff's work on a day-to-day basis? Ignoring the ways in which day-to-day supervisors have been invested with authority over other employers that empowers them to harass, the court ruled on Monday that employers are not vicariously liable for harassment by day-to-day supervisors who do not have the authority to hire, fire, and the like. Now, that is an amazing thing that they just did right there. Because now corporations can establish themselves with, let's say, only our HRO department can fire. So our supervisors on the floor are basically, if they don't have that right to do that, then they can't harm you. So it insulates the employer from liability from the harassment on the floor, which is exactly what this court just did, which is throwing out decades of legal precedent right there. And of all this is happening in silence, of course, in our 1% media. So it says, indeed, showing even more solicitousness for the interests of employers that the defendant in the case had shown for itself, the majority adopted an even narrower interpretation of the word supervisor than had been urged by even Ball State, the defendant. So, I don't know if all you gentlemen have been talking about Citizens United understand the history of how that case developed, but I want to point something out. How the court decides to be activist, because that's a perfect example of the court being activist, because they're taking a question further than they're being asked. Citizens United free speech issue in that case was not even before the court when it first went up the ladder. The court actually decided to bring that issue into the case and send it back down to be briefed again. It was an amazing thing that happened, and when it happened, it threw up a red flag to a lot of us that like to keep track of this stuff. The thing about Citizens United and the First Amendment decision I'll submit to you is the same reason why the Fairness Doctrine was actually written correctly when they removed it. The argument is correct if you accept by the court and the United States Congress that corporations are people. Because if corporations are people, then they have the same free speech rights that we have. So, In Title I of the United States Code, which of course by the fact that it's number one, says it's pretty much going to dictate how things are described throughout the entire United States Code. In the section Title I United States Code at subsection 1, it says words denoting number, gender, and so forth. This is right out of the book. In determining the meaning of any act of Congress, unless the context indicates otherwise, Words importing the singular include and apply to several persons, parties, and things. Words importing the plural include the singular. Words importing the masculine gender include the feminine as well. Words used in the present tense include the future as well as the present. The words insane and insane person and lunatic, etc. So you get the idea of what they're doing here. They're giving a basis where somebody cannot come back and say these certain terms will invalidate a law because those things have been litigated. So the next sentence is relevant to this discussion. The words person and whoever in any law in this country that is written, according to Title I, United States Code, Subsection 1, include the following: corporations, companies, associations, firms, partnerships, societies, and joint stock companies, as well as individuals. So I'm not sure how many people are aware that even exists, but now you have two branches of government who are telling you and I that corporations are, in fact, people. And so what's left to balance this out in our three-branch balancing government is the executive. And we all know what's going on there. So here's where we are. The court is interpreting rules based upon corporate personhood. So if you look at it that way, of course, I told you, everybody knows I disagree with corporate personhood, and I believe that it is the foundation to knock all of this down. If you accept the court's argument, then you have to accept the fact that they're correct in Citizens United, because Congress intended for corporations to be treated as individuals in every law that they create. There's our problem.
I won't disagree. I won't disagree.
Wow. Did you take a breath in there at all? That's what I want to know. he's on a roll.
So, Bob?
Yeah.
So you clearly have done a tremendous amount of homework, and everything you're saying makes perfect logical sense. I guess my only question really is that would you really consider that to be the desired intent of that language to define a corporation as a person? And if so, then would you consider Citizens United to be the decision that is the ultimate achievement of what the Congress actually wanted, so that they could continue to do the kinds of things that benefit them financially, benefiting them meaning themselves as legislators and ultimately their employers when they go through the revolving door? Is the plot even longer and more nefarious than we even think it might be?
Oh, totally. And let me first answer the desire thing that you mentioned. The words are it is not a desire or you don't have to assume. The words are clear. Congress wrote it very clear. If the word person is in a law, it includes corporations. There's no ambiguity in the statement. It's ludicrous. Now, the court, of course, is not innocent in this aspect, because how this all started is literally back to 1816, when the court gave the power. What the court did was, if somebody brought an action against a corporation and went up to the Supreme Court, and what the action was about was, does a corporation have the power to enter into a contract? So the court said, yes, it does have the ability to enter into a contract. Well, they took that and ran with it and turned it into a person. So when you have, and this is 1816, we're talking the beginning. So when you have, just to give you a brief bullet point, number one, the Tillman Act of 1907 banned corporate political contributions to national campaigns. Bullet point number two, Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971, campaign financing legislation. Number three, 1974 amendments to the FEC Act provided for a first comprehensive system of regulation, including limitations of the size of contributions and expenditures and prohibitions on certain entities from contributing or spending disclosure creation of the FEC as a regulatory agency and the government funding a presidential campaign. Next one, a very important case in all of this, Buckley v. Vallejo. Buckley is the Buckley that was the United States Senator that brought this case that challenged all of this. He's pretty much the guy who started sending this down the bad way. It says, Buckley v. Vallejo upheld limits on campaign contributions, but held that spending money to influence elections is protected speech by the First Amendment, which was the basis of the case. In 1980, Ronald Reagan, or not 80, I think it was 83, Ronald Reagan threw out the Fairness Doctrine, which held media to a standard of truth, essentially, because of the First Amendment ruling that we're talking about here. Then the next issue is First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, upheld the rights of corporations to spend money in non-candidate elections, i.e. ballot initiatives and referendums. Next one, Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, another important case in this scenario, upheld the right of the state of Michigan to prohibit corporations from using money from their corporate treasuries to support or oppose candidates in elections. This is the case that was overturned. Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, John McCain and Russ Feingold, banned the corporate funding of issue advocacy ads which mentioned candidates close to an election. Another act that was thrown out. This is the basis of Citizens United. McConnell versus FEC, substantially upheld McCain v. Feingold, another case that got thrown out. The FEC versus Wisconsin Right to Life weakened McCain-Feingold, but held the core of McConnell. Citizens United. The Supreme Court of the United States held that the corporate funding of independent political broadcasts and candidate elections cannot be limited under the First Amendment, overruling Austin and partly overruling McConnell in 2003. This is 7 years later. And lastly, the Western Tradition case, the Montana case, in which Montana made a law that prohibited corporate spending in elections, and the Supreme Court threw it out summarily without even hearing argument. And that essentially is your history of how this court has moved in such a short time to open all of this up and how Congress has given them the carte blanche to do it.
So recently, I just discovered online something called, and you guys probably know about all this already, but I just found out about the American Anti-Corruption Act.
Yes.
Have you?
It was actually part of the Middle Ground about 3 months ago. Eric Beiler and Michael Charney had the person on the show that actually is involved in that and talked about it extensively. I'm actually a member of it. And it is a wonderful, wonderful piece of proposed legislation. It might even been longer than 3-4. Actually, you know what? It might even been before the election that they had it on. But if you go on to Block Talk Radio and look at the past shows, you can find the show about it and the gentleman that is involved in creating the legislation and what the purpose of the organization is on the Middle Ground.
The former FEC chairman.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm already signed up. I'm already starting to spread the word. I've registered, so I've got the place where people can go and like co-sponsor with me. And it does seem to me to be a really logical, really doable, and something that would create the sort of outcomes that I think we all want. And that is whether or not Citizens United ever gets overturned. The pathway to amending the Constitution to doing that will take maybe decades. What this American Anti-Corruption Act is proposing only requires Congress to do the right thing.
Forget that.
Well, all we can do is make our voices known, make our voices heard, make our desires known. And if enough of us can do this, at least we're doing something. It feels like, to me at least, there's and I'm all for whatever it takes to to overturn Citizens United, but you know, I'm no constitutional scholar, but I think at this point it would require an amendment to the Constitution, and that's a long, arduous road that requires quite a bit of willingness on the part of the states once I guess it gets out of Congress. What is it, 3/4 of the states have to ratify it?
No, you're right about that. Yeah, you're right.
Well, but here's the let me throw in a comment. Hey, this is Dan Aronson, the host of the radio show.
Who?
I'm just I don't even have to do the show. I'm sitting here talking to my wife, going, "Oh, these two guys are very entertaining." No, but I did actually the first time I ever met Eric Beiler. He was here and he was speaking at a function at Washington State University in Vancouver, and they had a constitutional scholar talking about Citizens United. And here's what she said. What she believed is, yeah, sure, you can go ahead and try to amend the Constitution. And just like you said, Greg, it's a arduous and long, you know, journey. But what she thought was, she thought that the case would come up again and be heard again. And her belief was that the court did not have enough data points to draw the line between the money and corruption and actual quid pro quo. And that she believes that the case will come up again and with more data points, and that will be how it will be reversed.
I'm not sure I'm following you, Dan. What does she mean, data points?
Well, because I mean, the ruling of the court basically said the mere appearance of or the potential for corruption isn't enough. If you can show quid pro quo, if you can show that Congressman A got huge money from this PAC and then acted in favor of that PAC, and you can show that as a quid pro quo, then they would say no. That would be illegal, and they would have no problems, you know, upholding a law that would forbid that. But that's what they said, and she said that there just wasn't enough data, there weren't enough data points collected showing the quid pro quo. Now, we've just gone through a national election cycle that should have provided us all the data points we need, or should provide us all the data points we need as the legislative sessions go on. And then at some point, somebody's going to be able to draw those lines very clearly for the court, and that the court would overturn it. That, again, this is what she was saying.
I disagree with that statement for two reasons. One is, number one, data points is not supposed to be part of the court ruling. One of the reasons why the Voting Rights Act decision is a little ludicrous is because they're talking about data. That's not what the court's job is per Constitution. They're supposed to interpret the laws that are written on the basis of whether or not they are, in fact, constitutional. So the data points is irrelevant. But let's make them relevant and go to my next point. There is plenty of data throughout the history of this country and in the history of prior court rulings about corruption and money in elections, which is why, for example, the bullet point list that I mentioned a little while ago is relevant to that comment, because I did was, you know, pick and choose cases. But this goes back to, for example, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886 is one. The slaughterhouse cases in 1872, there's more than one of those. All of these cases involve corporate financing. And then, of course, the other aspect of the corruption angle is the unions, because there was always the same discussion going on with the unions where, you know, Jimmy Hoffa, the union money was corrupt. It was flooding. I have arguments today with people about, well, look at what the unions have done in money. And I'm like, what, does that mean that corporations should be allowed to do it now, like, because they didn't get a chance? You know, we have all the data we need when it comes to money and corruption.
Yeah, it occurs on both sides, and you have to clean up everything.
Yes, but the data point,
I would have a problem with that.
It doesn't matter for both sides. It's just to think, because it's almost like a generational, a lack of a generation doing its homework, to think that this is the first time in history that this has happened would negate the reason for having finance reform discussed in every election in my lifetime.
Hmm. Good point.
Well, what really impressed me about the American Anti-Corruption Act was the way in which it approached the amounts and the transparency of money that would be used for getting people elected. There's no denying that it takes money, and people will always be looking for ways to circumvent those avenues in order to buy the kind of influence that we, I think, realistically know happens with every single election. What's really making it hard now, I think, for all of us, is that there's not enough transparency. The idea that people who work for campaigns who now go and work for super PACs who are ostensibly not able to and don't, in fact, collude with the campaigns. I mean, you have to be pretty naive, even more than me, to believe that that's not happening. It seems like if we're gonna do anything, the kind of movement that the Coffee Party is, what the American Anti-Corruption Act represents, the 535 campaign, we just have to keep trying to spread the word to the people that we know, our own networks and family, friends, social media contacts, try and get more individuals engaged. I think there's a sense of not apathy so much as defeat and surrender on a lot of people's parts. And then the other side of that coin seems to be.
I was just going to say
the other side of that coin seems to be, and I know far too many people that think this way, I think, and that is that it's perfectly fine for all this dark money to be coming into elections because they want to see a tipping of the scales in favor of candidates that they want to see get elected, and those are almost exclusively. In fact, I can't think of a single instance in which that kind of conversation doesn't happen with somebody who identifies themselves as a conservative, as a Republican, who wants big money to be involved in government because of this mythology and fairy tale of the invisible hand and free markets and trickle-down economics. It's that combination of things that if you're outside of the 1% and you believe that stuff, you've been duped. There's just no other way to say it nicely. You've been duped. And the Republican Party, I think, counts on that to a large extent.
That goes back to the math I always do, right? So you've got 47% of the Americans voted for Romney. If you take out the couple of percent that actually would have benefited from a Romney presidency financially, then you've got, basically, 40% of the Americans that voted against their own economic self-interest. So what the Republicans do, in my opinion, is that they set up these other battleground issues that are strictly opinion-based and faith-based, right? So they always go to the gay marriage and the gun control and the women's right to choose and that kind of stuff, which, I mean, let's, you know, it's...
And they just
deflect away from that.
When in the Kerry elections, to echo your point, Dan, they put gay marriage on the ballot in 20 states and polarized their base. They didn't want George Bush back in the presidency. They didn't care about Kerry either. He wasn't a good candidate. But they polarized their base, and they put it on the ballot in 20 states.
Yeah, I think Joe was one to get in there.
Just briefly. I don't know how to put this. I don't want to bash a party, in particular the Republican Party. There once upon a time were reasonable people in the Republican Party that recognized there's a joint binding of ways, if you will, between labor and the upper class. There always was an upper class. Now, I'm remembering the 60s. I was a person that I didn't care for people that made a lot of money being taxed at 90%. Okay? It just wasn't fair. It did keep the economy in balance. It kept everything. I can see that now with hindsight. But at the same time, these same people in power, offered job programs that promoted people. I mean, we had the greatest economic boom, if you will, for the middle class than the country's ever seen. What's happened since, and I hate to point fingers, I voted for the guy twice, but Ronald Reagan, it's reversed. And I'd like to bring that balance back. I don't have a problem with people making money and even having power making that money. As long as that power is manifested in a way that benefits us as well as them and not just them. There's a greed factor that's grown into this that has really gotten me annoyed. And if I want to point a finger at somebody, I won't point a finger at a party. I'll point a finger at a person, Grover Norquist, all right, who seems to feel, in my view, that we shouldn't have a government, that we should shrink it down so much we can drown it in a bathtub. You drown something and you're going to kill it. And what will occur after that is what really scares me. So if we can facilitate a way, and I don't know how, and I don't think it's possible, but I'm going to try to bring out those people there that may be party affiliated, but make them aware that we have to do this together, and it's give and take on both sides, we'll get a lot further.
No, I totally agree with you, Joe. The genie's out of the bottle, and you're not going to get it back in. You know what Jeanine Loudon always preaches about is the big downfall was the creation of things like 401ks. When the stock market became the way to make money, instead of a way for a company to go out and find capital so that they could grow and invest, it became the primary source of a way companies made money. And then, of course, then Wall Street, you know, blew up because all of our retirement funds were funneled onto Wall Street, giving these guys the ability to make humongous amounts of money trading our retirement funds. And, of course, try to get money out of your 401k. You know, there's a reason why there's a penalty, right? And why it's significant. That's because they want to hold on to it. They're using your money to make money. I thought you were going to point the finger at Reagan, and I would have been happy. That's fine, but the whole concept of everything they did financially made the country. It turned it from a we to an I. That's right. When we turned the corner from being a society that we already actually cared about each other and where it was cool and all boats would rise with the tide. And you go back to the 50s and the 60s, and what you see is, and this is, I think, the biggest indicator, the one that puts the stamp on my forehead for me, is that back then the average CEO pay was about 66 times or 67 times that of the average worker in the company, where now it's like 400.
So, let me add to something in support of what you're saying. What happened around 84 to 86 is the one world economy. That's when corporations weren't corporations anymore. They started becoming multinational. And their concern was their shareholders and not the country that they were in. They felt they were part of the world, so they look at things in a worldview and forget basically who United States citizens are. Now, I would give them this in fairness. If they want to be that way, fine. But you are no longer entitled to the protections given to corporations that consider themselves American corporations. I think I posted a piece on that, by the way.
Well, I would like to add and agree, Dan, with what I believe you were saying, and that is that, and I'm old enough to remember this as well, that there was a real sea change that occurred in the 1980 election, in which a man who found a way to sit in the White House and never fire a shot in 4 years was ridiculed, made to look like a weakling, when you know Carter cared about people. I'm an atheist. I don't care what religion you are. I would like it if more Christians actually lived like their doctrine tells them to. Carter was the closest thing I think we ever had to a president who actually got it, that really understood that we have to be in this together, and we don't have to kill each other in order to live a good life and a safe and secure life. And nobody's without their faults, but what happened, in my own humble opinion, in the Reagan years, was that we made that turn, and we made that turn dramatically from a society that actually did care, at least to some level, about each other and about trying to do what was right and best for the whole country, even for the whole world. I mean, that was the day when the environmental movement was actually starting to get some legs. You know, Reagan comes into office and tears solar panels off the White House, as if that they were some sort of a, as if they were some sort of an insult or something. You know, it was a big change that occurred in those Reagan years, and so I go on record putting all the blame at his feet and at Alan Greenspan's feet, a good close personal friend of Ayn Rand. We have to be able to stand up and call out these individuals for doing what they did, and we've got to call out our fellow citizens for continuing to believe the fairy tale and the myth, because it's hurting all of us. It's going to kill us if we don't change it. And so I won't stay silent, and I will point fingers. I will gladly point fingers.
I think you've heard me say before that I believe that a revolution should have started when Reagan was presidency, and a lot of our selfishness. I mean, look at the battle of just on the HIV virus. If you monitor that from the social standpoint, and you don't even have to go into the economic threshold. And then of course the buildup in the military industrial complex, and then of course the prison industry exploded under Reagan. He put so many judges in office that it created a whole new circuit, for example. It's absolutely a throw it at Reagan, 100%.
And when you privatize prisons, what do private corporations do? They do everything they can to make money. The idea of our society having the greatest rate of incarceration, it's mind-boggling to me that, the war on drugs was a perfect way to fill up jails. It's a perfect way to fill up jails. While other countries, don't even consider, things like marijuana to be anything other than, a recreational drug akin to alcohol, we're throwing who into jail? Who gets thrown into jail for that? Minorities, poor people, the folks who would be voting against the Republican Party. That's who got thrown into jail. That's who's sitting in jail today. When you get thrown in jail, guess what you don't get to do anymore when you come out?
Vote. And what, 32 states, I think it is, or whatever it is, they take away your vote in state elections. Yes.
Exactly
right.
Exactly right. I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but, to me, there's a lot of writing on the wall that's pretty obvious. And what to boggle my mind is how anybody outside the 1%, especially middle class and poor white people, will continue to vote, as you said, Dan, against their own economic and their own social best interests.
Yep.
They don't get it.
Yeah, Dan, let me chirp in here a minute.
Chirp away.
What Greg was touching on, all right, with the prisons, all right, it's manifested itself even more. They want our school systems. They want all our public services.
Right.
It's gone beyond. You look at Michigan. They want to take over Detroit. They literally take over towns and cities, and by dictatorial rule, without regard to elected representatives because of, quote, economic reasons, unquote, okay, they will do whatever they want, all right? And, yeah, it's starting to balloon into something that is ugly. Look at Wisconsin. Wisconsin's like a place that, like, you know, I admire a lot of the citizens there, all right? But they took away all the rights of workers. They virtually destroyed them, right, to make the economy better. And the last time I looked, their unemployment, their standard of living took a dive because of it. But Scott Walker takes bows for it. And you have the 1% media, you know, acclaiming him for it. I'm at a loss as to where we're going to go to get these people woken up. I mean, in my area, people are, I won't even say apathetic. They just don't care. Now, in fairness to my neighbors, they work, like my son, who doesn't, you know, I mean, he's got two kids already. Him and his wife is working, and they'll complain about a lot of things, but when you tell them they have to do something, they don't have time. I mean, where do we go with this?
Well, this is Greg. I've been there recently myself. I just finally got two kids graduated through college, so you know I'm done with a lot of the things that young parents are tied into these days, and I can appreciate and empathize with what your son is going through. That's why we need to do things like make it as easy as possible for people like your son to get enough understanding and information and simply sign on to help us. Sign on to the 535 campaign. Sign on to the American Anti-Corruption Act. All you got to do is put your name on the list kind of thing. You know, that to me is for those individuals who, you know, aren't spending 2 hours on a phone on a Monday night like we are, we got to make it easy for them. We have to make it easy for them. And we got to keep in front of them. We got to keep reminding them. We got to keep asking them. I live on the fringes of Pennsylvania. I've been to tea parties. These people are active. This is what they're doing. They're making it. I hate to use this term, but it fits. They're dumbing it down so that it becomes a matter of, just like I think it was Bobby was saying earlier, they make it, or maybe it was Dan, issues that are charged. They make it about protecting gun rights. Well, we got to make it about protecting kids. They make it about, a religious argument about when life begins. We got to make it about a woman's right to choose. You know, these are the kinds of things that if we're going to have any influence on our friends and family and our neighbors, we've got to be ready with almost as simple of a counterpoint as you can come up with, and then give them something to do that adds, you know, it is an additive measure, like the campaigns the coffee party is running, like the campaigns that the Anti-Corruption Act is pursuing. That's my suggestion.
You know, there's two parts thing that I want to comment on. First off, I agree with the majority of what you said, but I will offer this. I do not give a pass to the Democratic Party on any of this. And I'll offer this up as the, and I'm not just talking about the fact that, you know, that about ideology. I'm talking about money and politics is there because everybody's got their hand in the cookie jar in a big way, not even by default. In my view, Nancy Pelosi has the power that she has because she is probably one of the 10 best fundraisers in the history of the planet. She is an amazing fundraiser for the Democratic Party, just as Boehner is for the Republican Party, for example. The Democratic Party has been in power a lot and has allowed a lot with the focus on social issues to distract us as well to happen. Remember what these people make and what their history is after they make it. You know, a good example is our distinguished senator that is retiring, who's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and how that committee, Democratic and Republican alike, how many people from that committee are working on lobbying Street or whatever. What is it? J Street? Whatever the street is.
K Street.
Where all the money in the lobbying organizations are. And I, you know, and I've said on these shows before, when our Coffee Party Radio is on, that one of my first disappointments of the President Obama when he became in office, because I'm sitting here like the rest of us, seeing where are we going to go with all of this, is one of his first appointments is Tom Daschle, who, because of the response to the base, decided to bow out of it, and a few other reasons. But Daschle's a money insider if there ever was one. And I submit that Bill Clinton is behind our problems as much as Ronald Reagan, and when he and the Republicans, or he and whoever, because it was Democrats as well, sat down and repealed Glass-Steagall and opened up
gates. Yeah.
That's as big as a deal, our recession crisis. I mean, our recession was as bad as any that's ever happened in our history. The Great Depression back then, what may be considered because people were doing all things or whatever, but I don't think it was, because the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and of course Glass-Steagall was recreated in response to the Depression. You're talking about a greater industry and a greater monetary base and a much more global economy that was impacted by the issues that happened besides the housing market, et cetera. So Ronnie and you know, the actor and Slick Willie, as I call him, really took us to task when it came to economics. And I was thriving during Slick Willie's years, like most of us were. So it's a trick, because if you talk about what the impact of a legacy of a president is, to me it's important that Reagan's legacy is as you were describing, and that it is not missed on Slick Willie's legacy that he repealed Glass-Steagall and handed the pen to the distinguished Republican senator standing right behind it on his shoulder there when he did it. You look at the... It's amazing.
You're absolutely right, Bob. Clinton was the guy who signed that Republican legislation. He was all for what was so well marketed to us as financial reform. That should have been the warning sign to anybody paying attention at the time. And again, I'll admit I was playing the role that Joe's son was at the time and not paying that close of attention to that sort of thing and not being very active. But, you know, as I point my finger at the Republicans, I pointed at the Democrats too. They have made huge mistakes in those kinds of actions. And most of the time, I think they're cowards when it comes to really – you know, the one thing you got to give the Republicans, and this was Ronnie's 11th commandment, you didn't buck the party. When the Republicans decided what their platform and their stance was going to be on an issue, there was no dissension. The Democrats, they get together, they can't find your ass with both hands.
That was Buck with a B, right?
That was Buck with a B.
All right, just checking.
With a B. Yeah.
Not that the censors are out and about on Blog Talk Radio,
no,
I'm sure.
No,
but
I'll keep it clean. I'll keep it clean. That's a PG-13 sort of thing, yeah.
All right, so this is the part in the show I'm gonna mute everybody quickly, and I got to do the pause for the cause. But then when I come back, I'm gonna go ramble on here for a second and promote all the Coffee Party's wonderfulness. And while I do that, you three gentlemen are going to give me three. You know how like sometimes in the State of the Union they come out with their 42-point plans to fix things, right? You guys are going to come at me when we come back one at a time, and we're going to open your mics, and we're going to get the three things that you would do to fix whatever issues you think are the most important and need to be addressed soonest. So pick the three issues and then give me the answers. Right, so we got it because we can sit up here all night and point fingers at these guys who are, some are dead and some are irrelevant now, and that's great, but we got to fix it. So the three things we need. And in the meantime, while you're thinking about that, this is Dan Aronson. This is Press One for Democracy. We're here every Monday night at 8 p.m. No, we're not. We're every Monday night at 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with more of this fun little roundtable discussions on whatever the issues of the day are. On Tuesday night, you get Coffee Party Radio's the middle ground with Eric Beiler, who's left-leaning, and Michael Charney, right-leaning, showing all about transpartisanship and how you can have civil fact-based conversations with people who are potentially your politically opposites and find the common ground and move forward, which is what the Cox Party, of course, is all about. On Thursdays, Lunch with Loudon, Janine Loudon, our COO, our Chief Operating Officer, and longtime radio host, will be with Debbie Lynn Molyneux at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. on the East Coast. They do a great talk show covering, again, a lot of issues. I don't want to say women's issues. I'm going to say motherly issues. I think they cover a lot of the motherly issues, like GMOs and women's rights to choose and women's right to equal pay and those kinds of things. So Coffee Party Feminists. I guess we can put it that way. And then on Saturday, we have Egberto Willis, and Egberto does politics done right. Egberto is our resident lefty, and I'm sure he will not mind me saying that, because he's proud of it. What he does is he puts a lot of people on the air. We have great discussions, and it's a kind of a roundtable-ish thing, much like what we're doing here tonight, on the issues of the day that he decides that he wants to discuss. So although a lot of times it's people driven, as are all coffee party shows, and we might start one place and end up going totally different place, and that's okay as long as we keep talking. That's the most important part. So what my last little plea is to say that we are member driven and totally 100% contributor driven as far as our infrastructure is concerned. We do have a movement called the 535 movement, or the 535 project, I should say, where we are going to get each and every one of the congressional and the president. So I guess it really should be 536, but we're going to get them on the record saying exactly how they feel about politics and money, whether they think it's a good thing, whether they think it's a bad thing, and if they think it's a bad thing, what they plan on doing to get it out. And then we're going to open that up and use that as a conduit to the rest of the world and allow people to come and find that out. And with the election in 2014 right around the corner, not that I really am anxious to go in another election cycle, although I don't have cable, so I'm not, you know, badgered by all the ads. But still, with that election cycle coming up, that should be a very valuable tool for getting a lot more exposure for the Coffee Party. So if you like what we do, please join. You can go to coffeepartyusa.com. You can join, and if you want to go into the Free the Elected section of it, you'll actually, for whatever you donate towards the Free the Elected, you will also get an equal value card, gift card at restaurants.com that could be used around town and around the country. So it's basically almost like getting your money back in a restaurant rebate. So with that, that's all of our sponsorship announcements. And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to open up. Let's see, we'll go in reverse order, which I believe makes Mr. Rodrigo up first, who's going to tell us how to fix everything that ails us. And I'm going to sit here and type.
First, as I state all the time, that we must reverse the legislation that allows corporations to be considered as people, as insofar as the Bill of Rights are concerned, and giving them the rights of a natural citizen. They don't vote, and they avoid criminal liability. It's one of the two biggest aspects of why they shouldn't be held as a natural citizen. That's number one. Number two is that I absolutely believe it's time that we break up the two-party monopoly in Washington. I'm working to do that myself with the United We Stand Fest and working with the Free and Equal Election Foundation. And the more I hear these discussions, the more research I do, the more research I listen to from people like Joe and Greg and yourself and all others in the Coffee Party, it absolutely is necessary to do that, I believe. And third is that we must be active. We have to do something. We have to engage ourselves. We have to use the power of the vote. We have to march. We have to teach people. We have to bring people into the fold, and we must be civil as we do it.
All right, so reverse corporate personhood, break up the two-party system, and educate and activate. That sound about right?
That sounds about right.
Perfecto. Let's go to Joe. Joe, your mic is open. Fix it, baby.
Okay, Tim. I got to chime in with Bobby on this. We have to get money out of politics. If it takes anti-corruption laws, an amendment, whatever people will agree on, that's primary. Motivating people to get into that, I'm really looking at voter registration. If we're being restricted now, we're going to have to get people out there. We're going to have to explain to them what's going on. If it's at all possible to get laws that are even so everybody's on the same playing field, I lend myself to an idea I heard about a while ago. It's a national holiday. You are required to vote. You must show up. Just the way you must show up to serve on a jury. Now, as far as activism, I plan to be going to the Martin Luther King 50th anniversary in August. I think the more people turn out, the better it will be. This may sound a little radical, but if you turn out in the streets the same way that people did in Brazil, okay, I guarantee you people will wake up. You get that kind of motivation behind people, and your government will listen.
All right. So we have get money out of politics, whatever it takes, mandatory voting, and more activation, and more civil or more visible protests. Bring back Occupy.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Definitely.
I thank you, sir. And last and hardly least, our first caller, Mr. Russick.
I think one of the things that I'm going to try and put more energy into is actually helping to spread the word on very specific, actionable items for people I know. Doing things like supporting the 535 campaign, the American Anti-Corruption Act, the Free the Elected. I think if we as individuals can create a bit of a ripple effect, we can make a difference. Because I'd also love to see the federal government's turn their priorities from subsidizing oil companies to hiring Americans to rebuild and rebuild our infrastructure. But I don't know how to make that happen. I can't. It's harder for me to see how I can make that happen than I can to really kind of take some ownership and responsibility for spreading the word about some things that people just like us can very easily do. We don't all have to be the leaders. We just need to make sure that people understand that there's an opportunity to add your voice to a movement and an organization that others are spearheading. And the kinds of programs like the 535 campaign, Free the Elected, American Anti-Corruption Act, those kinds of things, if we look at this as an opportunity to market this to our friends and neighbors, I think we can help to make a difference that way. So, just from a purely kind of tactical approach, I agree with everything that you guys are talking about in terms of what we need to do. The big challenge is how. How does that happen? How does that get done? I'm going to vote. I'm going to keep voting. I can barely wait for the 2014 election. But somebody else has to go with us. We've got to make sure that we are doing what we can, I think, to inform the people that we know. And ask them to do that, the same thing with the people that they know. Sorry, that's not three things, Dan.
That's okay.
Like
hey,
one.
You know what? It's no, well, but you're. It's one. It's support the actionable ideas, and that's fine. Like you said, I mean, you know, an army needs generals, but it needs captains, and it needs privates. I mean, you got to have so. So some people are the idea people, and some people are the doer people. So you're going to be a doer person. You know what? That's in the end, the army is all about the privates. It's not about the generals. So you're the one who's going into the trenches and fighting the war. So no, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. All right. So
gentlemen,
then I guess we'll close.
Quick, I've got to go. I have a conference call. It's going to start in about 5 minutes. Activism never sleeps, as they say. And I look forward to talking to everybody again. And please keep an eye on the Free and Equal Election Foundation, United We Stand Fest, along with everything else. And everybody have a wonderful weekend and 4th of July.
Thanks, Bobby. Appreciate it.
How about you, too?
Same to you.
All right. So we'll close off the show then with my three things, okay? My three things are fairly simple. One, we need a third party. There is no doubt. The good news, there's 81 million people that didn't vote in 2014. We're going to activate those people, and without changing one single Democratic or Republican mind that doesn't want to come along for the ride, we'll sweep into power. When we get there, we will take the profit motive out of service. It's not a, don't worry about stopping it at the funnel. We'll just make sure it has no place to go. We'll make sure people cannot get rich serving their country. Once we do that, we'll have the right people in place. We will fix the tax code. We will make sure that everybody's paying their fair share, and we will start a massive jobs program to fix the infrastructure of this country. We need that. We need to fix the infrastructure of this country. That will include training people at skilled to become skilled laborers, so we'll get a better workforce, and we'll become an industrialized workforce and move back towards the manufacturing era and away from this services era, which really plays into the hands of the global players who don't give a rat's behind about some guy who has to sit there and flip burgers who used to be a welder who doesn't have anything to build left. So that's my three things of how we're going to fix it. If you care to learn more about what I feel, you can always go to my website at partyrecon.org. So I guess there's progressive coffee parties and there's Republican coffee parties and Tea Party coffee parties. I guess I'm the third party coffee party guy. So so whatever it is, whatever it takes and whatever you want to do, the fact is doing things is what it's all about. We can sit here and we can talk about it, but we got to find people like Greg and activate them and get them involved. And once we do, I think we can change the world. So this is Van Aronson for Press One for Democracy. It's been great hanging out with you. Please come back soon. Then I'm going to play us out like I played us in. Have a great night, and as Janine Loudon would say, coffee party on.